Thank you, Andre. So, yes, I've been working on the owner effect for about a year now, and yeah, I would like to talk to you about well, first what it is, and then how it can be connected to some classical results such as radiation. So, before starting, I just wanted to thank well, the people I mentioned here: Atsushi, Bob, Gianluca, my supervisor, Subir, and Antonino. That have helped me understand this effect, and I think we can start. So, okay. So during the presentation, I'll first give some motivations as to why this effect is interesting and useful. Then I will very briefly talk about some aspects of quantum fields in curved space. So, although the Unruh effect is something that takes place in flat space, there are some elements that are useful from curved space. Then we'll talk about the Unruh effect itself. And afterwards, I will discuss how it can be related to classical radiation. Finally, I will show two experiments that have been proposed in order to verify the validity of the effect itself. So, starting with the motivations, I just wanted to show an interesting picture. So, this picture was taken in 1988. It is well, Feynman's last blackboard, and in this blackboard there is a section that is labeled "To Learn," so that contains some items. One of which is called acceleration temperature. So this is another name for the Unruh effect, which shows that, well, it was on Feynman's list of things to do. So other reasons why it is an interesting effect is because it is connected to particle creation in some curved space. So particle creation can happen just because of the expansion of the universe, and this is why there have been well many studies trying to look at particle creation during inflation and radiation domination when the well Hubble rate was very high. And another example of particle emission in a curved space was discovered by Hawking in the 70s. And well, now has the name of Hawking radiation. So it is the fact that black holes emit radiation. So another, so one could ask through the equivalence principle, is it maybe possible instead of being an observer, inertial observer in flat in curved space, to be an accelerated observer in flat space and still see some particles? So, and this is where the Unruh effect comes into play, and we will see how, for an accelerated observer, the usual vacuum well appears to be something that's filled with particles. So, I also wanted to show some of the li literature that has been written on the Unruh effect. And the papers can be divided into two categories mainly. The first one being the papers that are in agreement with the effect itself. So here I only list a very few of them. There have been many, starting with the one by Fuling, so some years before the discovery of the Unruh effect itself. And Fuling actually realized and showed that the vacuum defined by accelerated observers does not coincide with the vacuum of inertial observers. So 2 years after that, Davies made another interesting observation, and he showed that an observer undergoing uniform acceleration in Minkowski space would see a fixed inertial mirror as emitting thermal radiation. So after these two discoveries, well, it was Unruh's turn to show that an accelerated observer would see the usual vacuum as filled with particles. And usually, when we refer to this thermal bath, We can call it, it's sometimes referred to as FDU, so Fooling Davis Unruh Thermal Bath. So the three dots here are just to say that there are many papers that have followed. And on the other side, we have, well, much fewer, but still some papers that question the existence of the Unruh effect. So I list some of them here. And well, one of them by Narozny and collaborators, written in 2002, was well a paper disagreeing on some points with the Unruh effect, and it was a paper to which Fooling and Unruh wrote a response 2 years later, and there was some discussion about this the effect itself. So just to say that it is an effect that has been the subject of some controversy. So now we can briefly go through some very general aspects of quantum fields in Kerr space. So for this discussion, I'm using so the two sources here. So the Unruh effect and its application is a very, very good review, as well as the book by Beryl Davis, Quantum Fields in Kerr Space. So starting very simply with so quantum field theory in Minkowski spacetime, if we consider a massive scalar field that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, a set of solutions to this equation is where the plane waves, where here the proportionality constant is fixed through some normalization of a Klein-Gordon product. And we define these modes, so solutions to the equations of motion, to be positive frequency if they are the eigenfunctions of the time derivative operator with eigenvalues given by minus I times the energy. So the way that quantum field theory is done is from the field we define a conjugate momentum operator, and we promote the field and its conjugate momentum to operators acting on Hilbert spaces. And we can write the field itself as an expansion over positive and negative frequency modes, with the coefficients associated to positive frequency being corresponding to annihilation operators, and the operators associated to negative frequency being creation ones. And the vacuum state is defined as the state that is annihilated by the annihilation operator. So all this is very known, but there are generalizations when we go to Kerr spacetime, where there are some properties that are no longer true in a general spacetime. And one of them is that in Minkowski space, all inertial observers would agree on the same vacuum. So in a more general spacetime, there is no reason to expect this. So the reason for this is that there are infinitely many ways to choose the mode functions F, and that means that we can choose different sets of annihilation operators, and therefore each one of them comes with a different vacuum. But we will be looking at particular case where we can still define what a preferred vacuum, let's say, is. And this is the case of a static spacetime, where the metric is of this form, where we have here the functions n and g that are time independent. And in this case, we can choose a set of modes whose time dependence is of this sort, where now we can interpret these coefficients omega as the energy of the particles. So we will keep this in mind when we'll go to flat space and talk about the Unruh effect. And finally, just to mention what Bogoliubov transformations are. So if we consider, in the case of a very general spacetime, two sets that I call here F1 and F2, they define two vacuum states, so 0, 1, 0, 2 here. And because the two sets are complete, we can expand one in terms of the other, where here alpha and beta are called the Bogoliubov coefficients. And this relation between the modes can be translated into a relation between the operators themselves. So what happens now when we evaluate the number operator of the second set using the vacuum of the first set is that we see that this product does not vanish, which means that an observer for whom the number operator would be a dagger a but for two, well, they would see particles where the other observer would not. So now that we've briefly mentioned some of the aspects of Kerr space, we can go back to flat space and talk about the Unruh effect itself. So for this, we will need to define the different Rindler wedges, and we will consider a two-dimensional space-time, where here Z is one of the space parameters. And we will define the following coordinate transformation, where here A is a positive constant, which can be has the physical meaning of a proper acceleration. And we define new coordinates, psi and tau, in this way. And to see which part of the Minkowski space they cover, well, we will divide our space into four parts. And here I've drawn the word line where psi is constant, which would correspond to observers undergoing uniform acceleration. So this coordinate transformation will cover only a part of Minkowski space. And we can do the same thing for the left Rindler wedge by defining new coordinates, psi bar and tau bar, and we just flip the sign for the Z coordinate. And this transformation will cover another part of Minkowski spacetime. So now what we have is that the Minkowski space, well, restricted to these two wedges, is static. And the, well, time translation is generated by the following Killing vector, which means that, as we saw in the case of Kerr space, this would define a preferred vacuum state that we will call 0R for Rindler, and that does not coincide to the Minkowski space, to the Minkowski vacuum restricted to this to these spaces. So as a comparison of what happens between Minkowski and Rindler spaces, in Minkowski space, the equation of motion for a massless scalar field, well, it's the Klein-Gordon equation, and we have the following Killing vectors associated to space-time translations. And because of this, we can choose the modes to be, well, plane waves of this form with an associated vacuum state that we call, well, zero M for Minkowski. On the other hand, in the case of Rindler, the equation of motion for the massless scalar field is given by this expression in the in using Rindler coordinates. And now we only have well, three Killing vectors associated to space-time translations, and here tau is, well, the new time the new time variable. And the solution of the equations of motion are given by this rather complicated expression. But if we break it down, the fact that we have, well, these three Killing vectors allows us to write the dependence on the perpendicular space, the perpendicular space coordinates and the new time in this way. This red function is the Bessel function and comes arises because, well, the metric now depends on the parameter psi, and this is just a normalization.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes, of course.
So, are you saying that that you've lost a killing vector, or are you saying that there's a, because normally the killing condition is a coordinate invariant condition, and so when you say there's only three killing vectors, is there like a boundary condition that gets rid of the other one, or what happens to the other one?
So it's not that it's getting rid of it. It's more like the in the Rindler coordinates, if I can maybe go back. So this killing so this boost killing vector is time-like in the in these wedges. So because, well, z squared is bigger than t squared, so which means that well, basically we can define now it defines time translations with respect to a new coordinate that we call tau in this case. And this can be seen by the fact that if I go here, that the metric now is independent of the coordinate tau. So it's not really that.
I don't disagree with those statements, but it's just that I'm counting how many linearly independent killing vectors I have. It shouldn't matter what coordinates I use to do it with.
No, it's not no, it shouldn't matter. It's just that I show here some of them. It's just I'm
I see the
showing
right
three.
four of them are there. It's just it doesn't matter if the other one's there. Okay, good.
Yes.
Thank you.
And so with respect to this to these modes, now we can define the vacuum state, the corresponding vacuum state of that I call zero Rindler. So basically, if we now go back to our picture of our 2D case, we can quantize our field in the right Rindler wedge using now the modes, the Rindler modes, and associating some operators that I call here AR for right, that annihilate the Rindler vacuum. We can do the same in the left Rindler wedge, and it would seem that we are not really covering all of Minkowski space because VR and V left only let's say exist in the in these wedges, but it is possible to extend them to all of Minkowski space, and we can write an alternative quantization of the field phi as a sum of these two expansions, and it will be an equivalent one to the usual Minkowski quantization. So, in order to see what the to see how we arrive at the Unruh effect, we would like to relate the Rindler modes to the Minkowski ones. So, in order to do this, we expand the Rindler modes in terms of, well, positive and negative frequency Minkowski modes that I here for the positive frequency I use the blue color, and the red one is for negative. And since we know the form of the modes VR and V left, we should be able to compute what the Bogoliubov coefficients are. So we can arrive at explicit expressions, but the main idea is that the coefficients beta are related to the coefficients alpha in this way. So this means actually that if we can cleverly co construct modes that are a smart combination of VR and V left, we will be able to write these new modes as expansions only over only positive frequency modes. So these new modes look like this. I call so we call them W, and they're a linear combination of right and left Rindler modes. And if you define these modes, well, it turns out that they can be written as an expansion over purely positive frequency Minkowski modes. So That means that if you now quantize the field with respect to these modes, where the annihilation operators that are associated with them annihilate the Minkowski vacuum. So the operators that are associated to these modes look like this. So in the end, what we have is we may not have that the operators AR and A left annihilate the Minkowski vacuum by themselves, but we have a combination that does. So from these relations here, it is straightforward to show that the number operator of Ringler observers, when evaluated at the Minkowski vacuum, well, not only it doesn't vanish, but also it comes with the Bose-Einstein distribution, where here the temperature is given by the proper acceleration over 2 pi. And this is the heart of the Unruh effect. So just to recap, the Unruh effect is basically the fact that the usual Minkowski vacuum agreed upon for all inertial observers, when restricted to these Ringler wedges, is seen as a thermal state with some temperature that is proportional to the acceleration. So if one also wants to stop here and make a small comparison between the Unruh temperature and the Hawking temperature, well, one will see that the expressions are very similar if we only replace the proper acceleration by the surface gravity of the black hole. So we've done these calculations using scalar fields, but I should also point out that this same procedure works also for other types of fields that are physically relevant. And and we will use actually this these notions for the case of the electromagnetic field in what follows, mainly because we are interested in classical radiation. So now for this next section, so I'll be discussing some results from a paper given by, written by Atsushi Iguchi et al., and also some of the more recent results we have found in concerning the relation between the Unruh effect and Larmor radiation. So if now we want to quantize the electromagnetic field in the Ringler wedges, very schematically what we would do is we would write the electromagnetic Lagrangian. We would add here a gauge fixing term in order for the equations of motion for our field A to be of this form. And in the right Ringler wedge, we would now expand our field in the following way, where now the only difference with respect to a scalar field is that we also have to take into account the different polarizations. So out of the four here, only two are physical and practically come into our calculations. So, and we also impose a commutation relation for this operator. So up until now, we haven't really discussed what happens when a detector of any form is accelerated. The Unruh effect is actually independent of the interaction of, not independent, but it's not a statement about the interaction between a detector and the buff. But if now we were to add an interacting detector, we would consider, for simplicity, a structureless detector that is accelerating, uniformly accelerating, and that makes a current which would interact with this Unruh thermal bath. In our case, we also assumed that the detector is accelerated for a finite time. So now, what does the interaction look like? So it is, basically, the interaction Lagrangian is of this form. And we consider a classical charge for which the current is given by this. Here, Q is the charge. And if we assume that the motion of our electron or charged particle is uniform acceleration, well, in Rindler coordinates, we would have the following current, where here by fixing psi at zero, we are making sure that we are using uniform acceleration. So if we want to make the interaction finite, what we can do is actually modify a little bit this current, and we would now introduce a function f, which would be one for a finite period where the charge will be accelerating uniformly, and that would drop off at infinity. So what this does actually is decharging the charge at infinities. So, and also because we want to still conserve the current, now the psi component becomes non-zero to ensure the conservation of the current. So very schematically, what the function f looks like is something like this, where it is one for a period of 2t and goes to zero at infinities. So now that we have defined our current and our detector, we can talk about the interaction with it with a thermal bath. So what Unruhenwald showed in 1984 is that the emission of a regular photon in the inertial frame would correspond to the emission or absorption of a Rindler photon in this accelerated frame. And Iguchi and collaborators showed some years later that you can actually verify this explicitly in the case of emission rays. So the picture one can have in mind is the following, that in an accelerated frame, we have a charge sitting at rest that is surrounded by this Rindler photons, and that can either emit or absorb photons, and that this picture would have an equivalent picture in the inertial frame. And in the inertial frame, we would have the charge which is accelerating with uniform acceleration A, and that would only be emitting photons, well, photons now that are regular Minkowski photons. So having this picture in mind, what we want to do in order to find what the rates are for emission and absorption of photons, we calculate the emission amplitude, which is given by this expression. Here, this state is a state of one photon, which has physical polarization 2, energy omega, and perpendicular momentum kPer. The absorption of a photon is corresponds to an amplitude given by this, and the total interaction probability now is the, well, let's say the integral or the sum of these amplitudes, while taking into account the Unruh thermal bath because this is what the particle sees. So this is done by multiplying the amplitudes by the thermal factor. And in the case of the emission, we also have to account for spontaneous emission of Rindler photons. So this is why we have this plus one in this expression. So now that we have these expressions, we are ready to calculate the rates at which photons are emitted and absorbed. And it is given basically by taking the probability, dividing it by the total interaction time. And well, we get this result, which has been known for 30 years it was shown to be of this form by Higuchi and collaborators. And what we have done more recently is to show that this absorption rate can also be written as an expansion over the Minkowski momentum kz, where here the function f is an explicit function, I just don't write it for simplicity, and what we gain by doing this is that now we can calculate the power emitted by this charge just by multiplying the integrand of this expression by a factor of energy, basically. So if you do the calculations, what you find is that the power emitted in the rest frame of the electron is given by the usual Larmor formula, which means that inside it, the Larmor formula encodes the presence of the Unruh thermal bath if you decide to do the calculation in the accelerated frame. So what I should also point out is that this this result would also pop out if you were to do the calculation using Minkowski modes and not Rindler modes, and in the inertial frame. So you can do this in two different ways. I should also point out that this result is only valid at tree level. So here we haven't taken into account effects like scattering or radiation reaction. We assume that the motion of the electron is always uniform acceleration. And I should also say that, well, this correspondence between a Larmor-type formula and the Unruh effect has also been shown in some other studies, in the cases of scalar fields or vector fields, but in the case of the while doing it in the inertial frame. And finally, I would like to show you two experiments that have been proposed in order to verify the validity of this Unruh thermal effect. And the first one I'm going to show is an experiment which has been proposed by Chen and Tanjima in 1999. And what they considered were two counter-propagating laser beams that were accelerating electrons. And they considered them to be polarized and having the same electric field and frequency. So now what happens is that if you place electrons at the position x equals zero, the magnetic field vanishes and the electron is doing an oscillation because only of the presence of the electric field. So during these oscillations, there is a period which is well approximated by uniform acceleration, and therefore, by the predictions that we saw before, the electrons should be able in their rest frame to feel the presence of the thermal bath. Because the electrons are accelerating, they are also emitting some radiation, which will be used to verify if the Unruh effect is there. And the first type of radiation is the usual Larmor one. But the authors also considered the radiation reaction. And it turns out that this is a process that can be more easily calculated in the rest frame of the electron. So they call this radiation Unruh radiation, which is not to be confused with a new type of radiation. So it's still radiation reaction, but it is calculated using the Unruh thermal bath. So now what happens is that small angles, because of these two types of radiations, we have two different spectra, and the angular dependence of the Unruh radiation is of this form, whereas the Larmor radiation is proportional to this factor here, where A naught is the laser parameter strength. So what this means is that there is actually a blind spot in the emission spectrum of the Larmor radiation. And if we were to place a detector at spherical angles phi equals zero and theta being 1/a0, this radiation would disappear at this point, and we would be able to measure only the UNRU radiation. So this would be one way to distinguish the two processes. And the second experiment I would like to show you is the one that's been proposed a few years ago by Kozella and collaborators. And basically, it's again about the acceleration of electrons. So what we have here is a cylinder along which we have electric and magnetic fields that are applied, and the electric field is along the z direction. And there are some electrons that are injected here from the top with some carefully chosen velocity v, and that make and there are assumed to make a U-turn around this little opening here. So from this opening, there will be some radiation that is emitted, and that will be captured by detectors all around the solid anchor here. So by doing some calculations, what they found is that you can calculate the number of photons that are emitted through this little opening. Well, to be precise, a number of photons per unit per transverse momentum, and it is given by, well, the time of the acceleration multiplied by the rate at which Rindler photons are absorbed or emitted in the accelerated frame. So the authors considered the bath to have some temperature T, which they didn't fix at the UNRU temperature. They left it as a free parameter. And what they proposed would be for experimentalists to find the number of photons, which can be found by measuring the energy spectrum. And the validity of the UNRU effect would be for experimentalists to say that the number of photons would correspond to the expression on the right, but with the temperature fixed at the UNRU temperature. So instead of waiting for experimentalists to conduct this experiment, in the second part of their paper, they calculated what this number of photons should be based on purely classical electrodynamics. And what they managed to show is that the number of photons is exactly the expression you would expect it to be, but with fixing the temperature to be the UNRU temperature. So their argument was therefore that if you believe in classical electrodynamics, you should also believe in the UNRU effect. And the fact that the UNRU effect is encoded in the Larmor radiation, as we saw in the previous sections as well. Okay, so to sum up what we have seen, what we have seen here, we talked about the UNRU effect, which is a quantum field theory prediction that has been the subject of some controversies. The statement is that the Minkowski vacuum, when restricted to the right or the left Rindler wedges, corresponds to a thermal state of some temperature that is proportional to the acceleration. We also saw that we also saw the correspondence between absorption and emission of Rindler particles in the accelerated frame and the emission of regular Minkowski particles in the inertial frame. And this has helped us connect quantities between the inertial frame and the accelerated frame. What we also saw was that at tree level, the Unruh effect is necessary in order to recover some results from classical electrodynamics, mainly Larmor's formula for radiation. And I would just like to finish by giving a reference to our manuscript, if someone is interested into looking at these results. And I will stop here, and I'll be very glad to answer any questions.
So, are there questions? Yeah, sure. So you said that there was a controversy about the Unruh effect, and you quoted some papers, but could you tell us what the controversy was about? Because you could say the same thing about climate change, that there are papers that talk about it as being no good, but it doesn't mean that we think there's a real controversy. So what is the controversy?
Yes, so that's a very good point. So there are many, many points, but the one I found quite interesting is actually one that that makes sense, and the idea is that at some point we talked about these purely positive frequency modes. Maybe I can put it in full screen, maybe it'd be easier here. So these at some point we said that these purely positive frequency modes were equivalent to using the regular Minkowski plane wave, right? So what I didn't tell you is that these modes are not really defined on the point t equals z equals zero, basically the origin. And the point of some authors was that it is not really an equivalent quantization, because the modes are not really defined at this point. So despite our effort to make these modes cover all of Minkowski space, there are still some points that are not really covered. One answer to this argument that seems to be valid is that these modes should be more seen as distributions rather than functions. So that means that if you take the integral of some test function f and you multiply it by w, and this test function has is also defined at the origin, because w is a distribution, you would still get a valid result. And another argument would be that if you want to calculate the two-point function, you can do it using the usual Minkowski modes. But if you do it also using the Unruh modes, you'd basically get the same result. So although there are some subtleties when doing quantization in this way, fooling the argument of Unruh and fooling and other people was that these concerns do not really affect the last results.
I have a question about this analog Unruh effect. There was, in fact, a meeting at Perimeter last year discussing analog quantum gravity and various Unruh type of effects. So what is the status of that? And can you elaborate on some example where it has been experimentally proved?
Sorry. I didn't really quite hear the question. Could you repeat, please?
I was talking about analog Unruh effect. Unruh effect in systems like condensed matter systems, where you have the mathematics looks like relativity theory with velocity of light replaced by some other, being replaced by some other velocity, but the quantum effects continue to be the same. So people have talked about Unruh effect in quantum matter. So can you comment on that?
The Unruh effect on quantum matter condensed matter?
Quantum condensed. That's right. For example, I heard a talk by someone about, if you take two-dimensional quantum Hall effect and then look at inhomogeneous magnetic field, then when you do the mathematics correctly, there is some kind of Unruh effect and
I
some
see.
prediction
I see.
arising and so on.
So unfortunately, I haven't heard about these. So I don't really think I can comment on that. But it sounds very interesting. But unfortunately, I haven't heard of it.
Meeting at Perimeter Institute, I don't remember, maybe May or something. A whole lot of lectures on Unruh effect in quantum matter. In fact, Unruh was himself was here.
I see. Okay. Thank you for letting me know. Thank you.
So, other questions? Okay, so maybe I have like one, maybe you said, but I missed it. So can you like maybe give some numbers on experiment that you described, like which acceleration are people aiming at, which is the intensity of the laser? I mean.
Yes. So first some numbers I can give maybe, so I haven't really written it. But if we look at the here, so maybe the first thing I could say would be about what sort of accelerations are we talking about in order to have let's say non-negligible temperature of the Unruh effect. And if I remember correctly, you would need accelerations around 10 to the 19 or 10 to the 20 meters per second squared in order to have one Kelvin for the Unruh temperature. So you need actually very, this is why it is something that's maybe hard to see, is also because of this H bar here, it would make the temperature very, very small. And regarding the lasers that you could use, so the best lasers for accelerating electrons, it turns out, would be lasers that are optical. So omega here would be of the order of 10 to the 15 hertz, something like this. And we are talking about lasers which need to have the strength parameter to be much bigger than one in order for this calculation to hold. So that means that you would need, I would say, laser energies above 100 joules per pulse in order to accelerate electrons to see something reasonable, let's say. And you also need, if you want to look at the accelerations, gather many photons, let's say, in your detectors, you'd need also a very high repetition rate laser. So something that could maybe operate around 10 hertz or something like this.
Okay, thanks. So question from Zoom. Okay. If none, we can thank the speaker again.